Ladies and gentlemen, please be seated. Good afternoon. My name is Nancy McEldowney. I'm the Senior Vice President here at the National Defense University, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you all here today for this very important dialogue. I'd like to begin with a special word of appreciation for the guests who have joined us today from universities across Washington, D.C., and as far afield as Lynchburg, Virginia, and Baltimore, Maryland. We are delighted to have you all here with us today, and we know that your presence and your unique perspectives will greatly enhance the dialogue that we will undertake. We are also joined today by students from the National Defense University, representing every service in the United States military, agencies, civilian agencies from across the United States government, and international fellows from our partner countries around the world. To all of you who are here today, and to those of you who are joining us virtually via our webcast, we are in for a fascinating hour ahead. Our subject today is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, an alliance that has delivered real security for over six decades. Whether the issue is Afghanistan or Libya, counterterrorism or anti-piracy, the NATO alliance has been at the forefront of our efforts to devise solutions to the challenges that confront us. And our speaker today is the man who leads that alliance. In his capacity as Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen has exerted an enormous positive impact on the world. Prior to assuming his current capacity as Secretary General in 2009, he has served as a parliamentarian, a member of cabinet, of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
Ambassador McEldowney, thanks very much for your kind introduction and for leading our discussion today. Admiral Rondo, thank you so much for hosting me here today. And bringing together an impressive group of young people for our discussion. And Ambassador Hunter, many thanks to you and your team for all the fantastic work you do for our alliance. I very much appreciate your years of dedication to NATO. Ladies and gentlemen, before we launch into our topic, please allow me to express my profound condolences to the families and loved ones of the American and European serving in the armed forces. And almost all of you are the same age as the NATO troops currently serving in Afghanistan. And I'm certain that you all have brothers and sisters, friends and colleagues who are serving on the front lines in Afghanistan. So I'm sure that you feel the recent losses particularly personally, as indeed we all do. It's been a tough week, but we must remember why these brave men were in Afghanistan. They were dedicated to helping the Afghan people build a safer future so that we can all be safer in our streets and in our homes. We cannot allow their sacrifice be in vain. We must honor their memory by completing our mission. And we will continue working with our Afghan partners to deny extremists the safe haven they will seek. I want to emphasize that the Afghans remain our partners. Afghan soldiers are alongside ours, fighting to protect the population against threats of extremist violence. Afghan national security forces are increasingly in the front line, and their losses are high. They want us to stay and help train and assist them so that we can achieve our common goal. By end 2014, they will be fully in the lead. NATO will remain resolute and will stick to the plan for transfer of security responsibility as we agreed with the Afghan government at the Lisbon summit in 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, as you heard from Ambassador Mageldauni, I was Prime Minister of Denmark. The United States and Denmark have a lot in common, except perhaps size. We share the same values of freedom, democracy, and prosperity. We share a desire to protect these values, and we also share a lot of history. Let me tell you three things about Danes and the United States that you may not know. A Danish-American soldier, Hans Christian Fibiger, was one of George Washington's most trusted commanders during the American Revolution. A Danish-American artist, Christian Gulager, made the first sketches of the U.S. symbol, the American Eagle, as well as a portrait of Washington. And on a personal level, I should note that my son is an American citizen. He and his wife have twins, also Americans, of course. I'm sure that I look like just another foreign politician with a name that is hard to pronounce. But for me, transatlantic security is not theoretical. It is very real and very important. My son's family lives in Illinois. My two American grandchildren will share the same security challenges as my two Danish grandchildren. And when NATO leaders meet in Chicago, Illinois, in 2 months' time, at the next summit, we will address security issues that will be vital for the future of our shared transatlantic family. Our Chicago summit will be an important event because NATO is busier than ever protecting our shared values and our shared security. Today, over 140,000 military personnel are engaged in NATO-led missions on three continents, from Kosovo to the coast of Somalia. Afghanistan, of course, remains our main operation. And it may surprise you that almost 40,000 troops there are European troops. We continue to keep the peace in the Balkans. And last year, we successfully enforced a United Nations Security Council resolution to protect the people of Libya. Now, let me describe briefly how NATO works. In essence, it's all about transatlantic teamwork. First and foremost, NATO is a dynamic forum for consultation on our security. Your voice carries a lot of influence because of the size and political and military power of the United States. But before a decision is made, all allies must agree. Every NATO decision is taken by consensus. So it has the legitimacy of collective agreement among 28 sovereign democratic nations. Second, all NATO allies are covered by Article 5 of our founding Washington Treaty. This Article 5 states that an armed attack against one or more allies shall be considered as an attack against all. All for one, one for all. And actually, the first time Article 5 was invoked was in the hours after the 9/11 attacks. Soon after, NATO aircraft deployed to help patrol and defend American airspace. That was visible proof of transatlantic solidarity in your skies. And Allied support to the United States has not been limited to countering terrorism. Following Hurricane Katrina in August 2005, NATO coordinated a major relief operation by European nations and delivered a huge quantity of food and emergency supplies. Third, NATO backs words with concrete action. Collectively, our military forces are the best in the world. Their training and equipment are second to none. And they have a unique record of getting things done, even in the most difficult circumstances. NATO doesn't just talk about security. NATO delivers security. And finally, NATO works more and more with partner countries. Partner countries as diverse as South Korea, Kazakhstan, Australia, and Morocco. And they want to work with us because they know NATO and they trust NATO. In Afghanistan, 50 nations are part of the ISAF mission. That's actually one quarter of the countries of the world and the biggest coalition in history. In Libya, our partners from the region gave us priceless political and operational support. And we are keen to engage our partners even more closely in sharing the security burden around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, NATO was formed during the early days of the Cold War. I know very well that for many of you, that period is ancient history. But I'm one of those who lived through it. And I remember how reassuring it was to be part of the NATO family in a very different, dangerous age. But the world today is just as dangerous, but in different and unpredictable ways. We face many new threats: terrorism, piracy, cyber warfare, the disruption to our energy supplies, and the world's most dangerous people getting their hands on the world's most dangerous weapons. These global threats are too big and too complex for any country to tackle on its own, even for your remarkable country. These challenges know no borders. They can only be addressed effectively together with friends, partners, and allies. And that is why today NATO is more important than ever. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary General, for that fascinating elaboration of NATO yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We have a number of friends and colleagues who have joined us today who I know are eager to ask questions of you, and you very generously agreed to take some of these questions. I'd like to invite colleagues who have joined us from universities outside of NDU to ask some questions to kick us off, if we may. Please.
Men jeg skal spørge på engelsk, så alle kan forstå det. How will NATO react should Israel ultimately decide to preempt Iran?
Great, excellent. While you keep the microphone, let me ask now, say it in English, what you said in Danish.
I said, good day, General Secretary. I'm Ruth and I'm Danish, but I'm going to speak and ask in English so that everyone can understand.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We wanted to make you feel at home as well as with your grandchildren. So thank you, Ruth.
Yeah. Please. Iran, of course. First of all, I would like to stress that NATO as an alliance is not engaged when it comes to Iran. Individual allies are, including, of course, the United States. Individual allies are engaged in a political and diplomatic effort to find a peaceful solution to the problems related to Iran's nuclear program. NATO as an alliance is not, and I would like to stress, we have no intention whatsoever to intervene in Iran. We do believe that the right way forward is the political and diplomatic process, and we hope that will bear fruit. Having said that, of course we urge the Iranian leadership to comply with their international obligations, including relevant United Nations resolutions, stop their enrichment program. But just to avoid any misunderstanding, NATO as an alliance has no intention to intervene.
Excellent. Thank you. Please, an international fellow who is here with us at NDU.
Sir, I am Colonel Janjgawa from Georgia. There will be no question about the Georgia joining NATO. We're applying strategic patience in this case. But, sir, may I ask you the question about how the NATO-Russian relations will evolve after presidential elections in March of this year? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. But though you didn't ask about Georgia, I would like to take the opportunity to express my gratitude for Georgia's significant contribution to our operation in Afghanistan. And we enjoy our cooperation with Georgia within the NATO-Georgia Commission, and Georgia has made significant progress during recent years in carrying through necessary reforms, not only when it comes to defense and the security sector, but also generally in the Georgian society. So it's remarkable what Georgia has achieved. And as you will recall, NATO has decided in 2008 at the Bucharest summit that Georgia will become a member of NATO. Of course, provided Georgia fulfills the necessary criteria, and Georgia is working in that direction. So I answered your no questions anyway. on Russia, I am pleased to see that we have improved our relationship with Russia during the last 2.5 years. Across the board, we have seen progress in our relationship. We have enhanced our cooperation with Russia on Afghanistan because the Russians share our desire to see success in Afghanistan. Among other things, they have provided a transit route for our equipment. We have enhanced cooperation on counter-narcotics, not least because the Russians suffer from drugs trafficking rooted in Afghanistan. We have strengthened cooperation on counter-terrorism, and also when it comes to counter-piracy. Actually, the Russians tabled some proposals recently as to how we could strengthen cooperation on counter-piracy, and these proposals were adopted. So I'm pleased to see that we have improved our relationship, because I do believe that it's in our interest to improve our partnership with Russia, an improved partnership, improved relationship, a true strategic partnership with Russia would benefit the whole Euro-Atlantic area when it comes to security, but more than that, also when it comes to economy. So I think we have a common interest in developing what we decided to do last time we had a NATO-Russia summit, a true strategic partnership. There is one stumbling block right now, and that is missile defense. NATO will develop a NATO missile defense system to protect our progress after the presidential elections. Paradoxically enough, but I think President Putin has the possibility, if there is a political will, to also move towards a closer relationship with NATO.
Excellent. As you look at the question of Russia and the future of Afghanistan, can you say a word to our guests about the goals of the alliance for that Chicago summit, which will happen in the second half of May?
Yes, in five headlines.
Yes, perfect.
Firstly, we will decide to build the NATO missile defense system and declare an interim capability of that. Secondly, we will adopt a defense package, a package of concrete capabilities that allies will commit. They will commit themselves to develop a number of capabilities in the coming years through more cooperation, because individual allies, in particular smaller individual allies, will not be able to invest, they can't afford to acquire expensive military equipment, but by helping each other, by pooling and sharing of resources, we can. Mm-hmm. So a defense package will be the second headline. Thirdly, we will adopt what we call a defense and deterrence posture review, which will decide the appropriate mix of conventional forces, nuclear forces, and missile defense to protect our populations. That's a third. Fourth headline is Afghanistan, the next phase. When we have handed over full responsibility to the Afghans by the end of 2014, what then? And basically, we will continue to train and educate Afghan security forces. And finally, partnerships. We will strengthen our partnerships.
Here's a microphone coming for you. Thank you.
Thank you. A very good day, Mr. Secretary General. I'm Wilson from Marymount University, and I'm from Malaysia. My question is, In this turbulent time of global financial crisis, and we see a cut of military spending budget, what concrete measures is NATO taking to ensure an effective and continuous operations for the safety and security for all? Thank you.
That question relates very much to what I just said about the defense package, because many people ask that question. We are in the midst of a period of economic austerity. Defense ministers are faced with declining defense budgets. How can they invest in the necessary military capabilities to protect our populations in the future? And that's actually a good question. And the answer to that is that it may be that we will have declining defense budgets, or at least not increasing defense budgets, but we can spend the money more efficiently. So we get more out of what we have. And the way to that is the concept we call smart defense, because it is a smarter way of spending money. And a smarter way of spending money is to help each other, as I indicated. Let me illustrate it with a concrete example. We need transport aircraft, in particular in Europe. For smaller allies in Europe, it's simply not possible to afford to acquire one such aircraft. But then 12 allies and partners, 10 NATO allies and two partners outside NATO, have now pooled and shared resources. And together, these 12 have purchased 3 C-17 transport aircraft. Individually, they couldn't, but together they can. So through this multinational corporation, we have now 3 transport aircraft we otherwise wouldn't have. This is an example that could be transferred to a number of other areas. We need air-to-air refueling. We need missile defense. I've already mentioned missile defense. Missile defense is also smart defense because a number of allies help each other to create this missile defense. We need drones, unmanned aircrafts to do intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. They are also very expensive. That can be done in a cooperation among countries. So in essence, this is the answer to your question, that we have to pursue smart defense, spend our money smarter, not least during a period of economic austerity.
Excellent. Please,
yeah. Zhigit Sapagovsky, United Nations Information Center in D.C. We are delighted to have you in D.C., Secretary General. Thank you very much for your presence. And my question is, do you plan to discuss the enlargement process of the Alliance Summit during Chicago this year? And my second question is, having the ICJ judgment ruling that Greece violated UN law by blocking Macedonia from joining NATO, will we see NATO stand by this judgment and support Macedonia on the upcoming NATO summit in Chicago? Thank you.
First, on enlargement, I don't envisage that we will extend new invitations at the Chicago summit. But having said that, we will reiterate our open door policy. Our door remains open to European countries that fulfill the necessary criteria. And we know that a number of countries are interested in becoming members of NATO. And we will reaffirm that our door remains open. But I don't expect concrete invitations extended at the summit. When it comes to the more specific question, about Macedonia or Fyrom, our decision was very clear when we discussed it at the NATO summit in Bucharest in 2008. said, we are prepared to start accession talks with the government in Skopje once a mutually satisfactory solution is found to the name issue. Let me here just tell you that there is a dispute on what should be the name of Macedonia. Formally, in NATO language, Macedonia is called the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, FYRO. It has been discussed. No solution has been found to that. We are prepared to start accession talks once a solution has been found. The International Court of Justice ruled or issued a ruling recently on that. I issued a statement where I reiterated what for starting such a text accession talks is that a solution to the name issue will be found. And I urge all parties involved to do their utmost to demonstrate a maximum of flexibility, because I would very much like to see all countries in the Western Balkans integrated in our Euro-Atlantic structures in NATO and the European Union.
Great. We believe in whole of government, whole of coalition and alliance solutions, and I'm going to try to work the whole of this room. So I want to move way over to this side. I see a hand right over here, this young lady. Please.
Hi. My name is Amelie Barrett. I'm at the George Washington University, and I was wondering, Secretary General, how you see the situation in Syria progressing over the next few weeks.
Unfortunately, I don't think we can speak about progress. It's really a matter of concern, and it's absolutely outrageous what we are witnessing. I strongly condemn the crackdowns on demonstrators in Syria. The only way forward in Syria as well as in other countries is to accommodate the legitimate aspirations of the Syrian people. That is, introduce freedom and democracy. Having said that, I would also like to stress that NATO has no intention to intervene in Syria. I think when it comes to Syria, the right way forward would be to find a regional solution. And in that respect, I commend the Arab League for their efforts to find such a solution, and I hope that will bear fruit in the not too distant future.
Terrific. Okay, can we move to this side? Please, the gentleman in the front.
Richard Cavalier, Marymount University. My question, Mr. Secretary, was about missile defense. Will the NATO missile defense system be stationed in Europe, and if so, will that undermine NATO-Russian relations as the Russians may see it directed towards them?
First part of your question, yes. We will deploy missile defense facilities in Europe. Obviously, a major input to the NATO missile defense system will be the American missile defense system. And that will, of course, be the core of the system. But European allies will contribute as well. Some European allies also have missile defense system to protect deployed troops. It's called theater missile defense. And these missile defense systems can be connected with the American missile defense system, and through that connection, defense can be expanded from just being a protection of deployed troops to becoming a defense of the whole population. Other European allies have offered to host interceptors, radars and things, Turkey, Romania, Poland, Spain has announced that they will host some maritime facilities. Other allies have made similar announcements. So it's really a joint effort. And that's why I also call missile defense smart defense, because it's about multinational cooperation with the aim to protect the whole population. Second part of your question, our relationship with Russia. Well, we have observed a lot of negative, maybe even threatening rhetorics from the Russian side. The Russian president has made announcements in November that Russia will consider to deploy some offensive weapons in Kaliningrad if NATO proceeds with the development of a NATO missile defense system. I can assure you that we will proceed. The NATO missile defense system will become a reality because we want to protect our populations against a real threat. And it's not in the spirit of that true strategic partnership we agreed to develop when Russia and NATO met in Lisbon in November 2010. It's not in the spirit of that true strategic partnership if Russia deploys offensive weapons directed against NATO countries, because NATO does not constitute a threat against Russia. Let me speak very openly about it. It's an absolutely crazy idea that we would have any intention to attack Russia. We don't. So to deploy weapons directed against an artificial enemy, that's completely waste of money. That money could much more efficiently be spent on economic and social development and modernization in Russia. That's really to speak about it in a very open manner. That's how I feel it. The Russians have requested guarantees that our system is not directed against them. But I mean, they have that guarantee already. Technically, our system is not designed to threaten Russia. That's the technical thing. But politically, we have already 15 years ago, in 1997, adopted what we call the NATO-Russia Founding Act, which is the first political document that frames our cooperation. In that founding act, we clearly state that neither Russia nor NATO will use force against each other. So we have that guarantee already. We will not use force against Russia. And we expect Russia not to use force against us. So in that respect, it's a waste of money to deploy such weapons.
Excellent. Let's see. Well, that's great straight talk. Thank you very much. Let's go all the way into the back here. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Anta. I'm from Howard University, Washington, D.C., originally from Senegal, West Africa. And I wanted to know, recently President Obama sent troops in the Sudan region. What is NATO's perspective in terms of the Sudan and South Sudan conflict? Thank you.
First, NATO has no intention to intervene in Sudan. But obviously, for us, it's a matter of concern to see instability spread in Africa, because weak governments or unstable societies can also promote extremism, in the worst case also terrorism that can link to international terrorism, and at the end of the day constitute a threat to our populations. So of course we follow such developments closely, but we have no intention to intervene.
Mr. Secretary General, you spoke very eloquently about Afghanistan in your opening remarks. We have a number of students here at the National Defense University who have done multiple tours in Afghanistan as a part of ISAF. If any of them would like to ask a question or make a comment, I'd like to invite them to do so now. They're going to be shy about their experiences there. Please.
Sir, Major Jeremy Kotkin from NDU here. Right now in Kabul, the NATO member states are working with your SCR to transition the provincial reconstruction teams to Afghan programs and development, because at the end of the day, they're counterproductive to what Afghanistan needs to do. Similarly, do you envision a time when NATO transitions into something else, because at the end of the day, it's counterproductive to the 21st century security environment or strategic environment as far as geopolitics in Western and Eastern Europe? Thank you.
Just to understand your question correctly, do you think about our post-2014 mission in Afghanistan, or more generally?
I was just using that as an example. I mean, about NATO specifically in and of itself, with relationship with Russia or NATO expansion, as opposed to what we've previously said wouldn't be expanded, or with missile defense, how it might be counterproductive to the strategic environment and peace we'd like to see, you know, with Russia or with the 21st century environment. Would NATO need to change at all, or would it maintain the same treaty bureaucracy that it was developed through the Cold War in a non-Cold War environment?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think it's fair to say that NATO has really adapted to the new security environment. And I think a strong, I would say, proof of that was our summit in Lisbon in November 2010. At that summit, we adopted a new strategic concept that really frames the new NATO, the NATO of the 21st century. During the Cold War, NATO was absolutely successful. We prevented the Cold War from becoming hot. And after the Cold War, NATO was also very successful in facilitating the reunification of Europe after the split in the wake of the Second World War. It was not least thanks to NATO that Europe managed to be reunified in an overall peaceful manner. Maybe the Balkans was an exception, but overall it took place in an orderly and peaceful manner, not least thanks to NATO. So I see NATO in these three phases. The Cold War NATO was NATO 1.0, the post-Cold War NATO was NATO 2.0, and in Lisbon, in November 2010, we started the development of a NATO 3.0. And that's a NATO focused on addressing the new security challenges, like terrorism, like cyber attacks, like missile threats, a number of emerging security challenges. And we are now developing an alliance that can address these security challenges. It's also an alliance that realizes that while territorial defense of our populations remains the core function, the core task of our alliance, we also we clearly see that the defense of our borders very often start far beyond our borders, like in Afghanistan. And finally, it's also part of our new strategic concept that we engage with partners across across the globe, because if we are to accomplish our security mission in today's security environment, we have to engage with partners. Let's take Afghanistan as an example. If we are to ensure long-term peace and stability, not only in Afghanistan, but in the region, we need to engage with Pakistan, India, China, other countries in the region. So this is really the new NATO. It's not a Cold War NATO.
Excellent. NATO 3.0 playing a role in the Arab Spring, operating in Libya, for example. Other questions? Here, please. Please.
My name is Michał Kosma-Maknowski, and I'm originally from Poland. I'm a graduate school student at the George Mason School of Public Policy. My question for you is, with regards to the security dynamic now in the Middle East, how important is Turkey's role within NATO, and how will NATO continue to leverage this friendship?
Turkey plays a crucial role in our alliance. Not only militarily, because Turkey has the second largest armed forces within our alliance, but also politically, because of Turkey's geographical location, because of Turkey's historical, cultural, religious background. And I think that was very visible during the Libya operation and more in general, during this period of the Arab Spring. So we attach a strong importance to the voice of Turkey, and I think Turkey can play a crucial role in dealing with a lot of the strategic challenges in that part of the world.
Please.
Yeah. Colonel Jasmin Čajić from Bosnia-Herzegovina, National War College student. I have short two questions. First question is, can you share a couple of sentences about Bosnia-Herzegovina perspectives towards full membership of NATO? And second one, during your presentation you mentioned cyber threats and cyber security. In terms of that contemporary threat, can you give us some information about relationship between common security defense policy of European Union and NATO towards cyber threat and cyber security?
On Bosnia-Herzegovina, as I mentioned previously, my vision is to see all countries in the Western Balkans integrated in our Euro-Atlantic structures, that is NATO and the European Union. That also includes Bosnia-Herzegovina. And this is also a reason why NATO granted what we call membership action plan status to Bosnia-Herzegovina on certain conditions some time ago. A membership action plan, that's an instrument we use as a framework for cooperation with countries that seek future membership of NATO. They may not fulfill the necessary criteria now. We help them to gradually carry through the necessary reforms, and one of the possible instruments to that is to have a membership action plan. So for aspirant countries, that's a strong desire to get a membership action plan. It's a visible sign that you're on the road towards a future membership of NATO. So we granted a membership action plan to Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is a positive thing, but we also set to the Bosnia-Herzegovina political leadership, we can't activate that membership action plan until you have carried through certain reforms. Now I'll not go into too many technical details, but in essence, it's about the handling of defense property in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Unfortunately, so far, we haven't seen any progress in that respect. Some time ago, there were elections in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It took quite some time to create a new government, but now political progress has been resumed. I hope to see progress also when it comes to that specific condition we have set for an activation of the membership action plan. The bottom line is I hope to see further progress in the relationship between Bosnia-Herzegovina and NATO, and one day in the future I hope to see Bosnia-Herzegovina as a member of NATO. But when, I can't say yet. It's very much up to Bosnia-Herzegovina herself. On cyber, of course, we never comment in too many details how we organize our cybersecurity, cyber defense, but as you indicated, a cooperation between NATO and the European Union is of utmost importance. Cybersecurity is also one of the issues where cooperation with a number of partners is crucial. So we have done a lot also to protect our own systems against cyber attacks. I think in average we have around 100 attacks daily against the NATO systems. There is a lot of interest out there in what we are doing. But so far we have managed to protect our systems, but we have to develop that security all the time.
Right. Other questions? Please, let's go back over here. This gentleman.
Thank you very much. My name is Mark Dietz, and I just finished my master's from Yale University. And I was wondering, we're seeing a rise in saber-rattling between Azerbaijan and Armenia and a possibility of renewed warfare. What might NATO be able to do, if anything, to address that? Thank you.
we try not to be engaged. We have a partnership with both Azerbaijan and Armenia. Of course, we use these partnerships to have a dialogue with both countries with the aim to find a peaceful solution to the conflict on Nagorno-Karabakh. NATO as an alliance is not engaged. Some of our allies are engaged in what is called the Minsk Group, which is the international framework for dealing with the conflicts in Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think we have time for a few more questions. Let's move right here, please. Right here. The third row. There you go. Please. The man with the microphone.
Thank you very much. I'm Mike Lichtenberg from the University of Maryland. I'd just like to ask, what are your views as to what would be the biggest threat to in cyberspace and NATO's views on WikiLeaks specifically?
An easy question.
On WikiLeaks, I really think I know very well that in some camps it may seem to be a heroic action to provide such what is called openness as regards international diplomacy or U.S. Diplomacy. But I can tell you that it's very damaging. It's very damaging for peaceful solutions to international crises because very often, if you are to find a peaceful solution to a conflict, then you will have to start informal, confidential talks with your adversaries. But if there is a risk that all that can be read on websites in the public sphere, then the interlocutors will be very reluctant to engage in such a dialogue in an open and honest manner. So such WikiLeaks are damaging. They're very damaging to international diplomacy and the efforts to find peaceful solutions to conflicts. That's to go directly to the point, I think, seen from my perspective. The major cyber threat, well, I think it's a security challenge that is evolving very fast, so I would be reluctant to guess about what is the major threat, because real world might very well go far beyond your imagination. But it's not just theory. Mm-hmm. I think it's now nearly more than 4 years ago that one of our allies, Estonia, was subject to a massive cyber attack. And there are a lot of lessons learned from that experience. This is also a reason why a NATO center of excellence focusing on cybersecurity is now located in Tallinn. And I think that's actually the best answer to your question, that we don't know exactly what might be the future major challenge, but we have experts focusing on that on a daily basis, and hopefully we will always be one step ahead of the attackers and able to protect our societies.
Excellent. Mr. Secretary General, if I may, what I'd like to ask is that we take two more questions. I don't want to overload you, but we're running short on time, and I want to make sure that we're able to get as many. I do want to make sure we get a student from NDU. So please, sir, and then we'll invite someone from over here as well to speak. Please.
Good afternoon, sir. I am Lieutenant Colonel Elias Ersti. I'm at the Joint and Combined Warfare School. Previously, I was in Istanbul with the NATO Rapid Deployable Corps Turkey. My question is regarding smart defense. Given the obstacles to the smart defense concept, including possible limits to national autonomy, differing views on levels of ambition for use of those capabilities, and general alliance politics, do you think the United States has any kind of a special role to play in helping shape the success of the smart defense?
Excellent. Okay, and then please, a question from over here. Front row, please. Sir, microphone coming.
Okay, my name is Yassin Abdi, and I'm from Marymount University. And I have a question for you, sir. In light of the resurgent Russia, how does NATO explain their vast military spending? Furthermore, do the event that happened in Libya recently, is NATO considering expanding its military involvement in the world, and is Somali on the table? Next.
The first question, would you please repeat that?
In light of a resurgent Russia, how does NATO explain their vast military spending?
Explain?
Their Russia's vast military spending, their huge budget.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes. Okay. Yes, okay. it's tough questions. on smart defense, there are a number of issues that need to be solved to make smart defense a real success. And you touched upon some of the potential stumbling blocks. And one of them, of course, is will individual allies be willing to give up their own military capabilities and hand over, so to speak, such military capabilities to a multinational project? That's basically about national sovereignty and the definition of what is a nation state. Furthermore, once you have accepted that I give up my national capability, I will do that work in cooperation with a number of other allies, how can I be sure that my investment will not be waste of money because some of our good allies are not prepared to actually deploy that military asset when it is needed? And if we don't find solutions to that, then some countries will be reluctant and they'll say, okay, if we can't guarantee more or less access to those multinational capabilities, then maybe it's better that we keep that capability so it's in our own hands to decide whether it can be deployed or not. So that's a real tough question, and we will have to deal with that at the summit in Chicago. But it's complicated because in many countries, it's a constitutional requirement that the parliament gives its consent before you can participate in an international military operation. So the question is, can you just hand over that decision to a body outside that parliament? So we have something to deal with. But the good news is that there is a strong political will within the alliance to find new ways to do business. People realize that not only during a period of economic austerity, but also in a longer-term perspective, we need to go for multinational projects instead of purely national solutions. We can see that the price of advanced military equipment rises more rapidly than inflation and our national product. So it's a long-term challenge. So we will need to help each other and also find solutions to the questions you raised. Can the United States play a role? Yes, indeed. And it's also the United States can facilitate such multinational projects, because once the U.S. engages in a multinational project, then it's also because of the size of the U.S. a kind of a guarantee that this project will be a success, and then others will join. And it is in the self-interest of the U.S. to facilitate such multinational projects, because that's the way to engage the European allies more and ensure a fair burden sharing within the alliance, because this is the only way in which smaller European allies can acquire the necessary military capabilities. So the U.S. can play an important role, and I think it's in the interest of the U.S. to play such a role. Now, on Somalia, NATO assists to a certain degree the African Union with some, in particular, transport facilities in the African Union mission in Somalia. So in that respect, we are engaged, but at a very low key level, at and on request of the African Union. And you also asked about Russia and the vast defense spending in Russia. Well, I think you should ask that question to Russian politicians, and they may be able to explain why they plan to spend that much money on defense. Because as I said earlier, actually I do believe that it is a waste of money, because it's directed against an enemy that doesn't exist. And I think it would be better for Russia to focus on real challenges instead of artificial enemies. But it's not my business. I mean, I'm Secretary General of NATO. I'm not President of Russia. please ask these questions to Russian politicians. They may be able to explain what, to my mind, seems to be a waste of money.
Terrific. We will invite them here for our next conversation. Yeah. But for this one, let me say, Mr. Secretary General, you have delivered, as promised, a fascinating review. You've taken us around the world, but you have also shown us vivid evidence that the world we face is increasingly complex, increasingly unpredictable, and in that kind of world, which these people will take leadership of, we need an organization like the NATO alliance that will provide the kind of security in the future that it has in the past. Thank you, sir, for being here today and for your leadership.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Okay, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd ask that you just remain in your place until the official party leaves. Thank you.